You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new book tells the story of lesser-known figures in American labor history and the impact they had on modern workplaces. We'll meet the author of the book, Fight Like Hell. Now, an immigration bill that sponsors say could lower food costs is in negotiation in the U.S. Senate. It would allow some migrant workers in the agricultural sector to work year-round in the U.S. instead of temporary seasonal work. The bill, known as the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, would directly impact farmers and migrants using the H-2A Temporary Agricultural Program. The bill passed in the House. Supporters are working to find at least 60 votes in the Senate. Details still being worked out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer hiring workers through H-2A, or would you like to be if the rules change? Do you think it is a good program? Do you want to see this act passed? In general, what questions do you have about the laws regarding immigrant workers in agriculture in Wisconsin and around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Costa is the Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And Philip Martin is a professor emeritus in agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis. He's a UW alum. Philip, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Can you spell out the basics? Again, the details are still being worked out in the Senate, but what do you see as the key elements of this Farm Workforce Modernization Act?
Well, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act is essentially a redo of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. So back in 1986, when maybe 10 to 15% of U.S. farm workers were unauthorized, there was a big debate in Congress over what to do about unauthorized immigrants. And what IRCA did in 1986 was legalize current unauthorized farm workers and make it easier for farmers to hire legal guest workers under a program known as the H-2A program. And the theory was that by legalizing currently unauthorized workers, those workers could come out of the shadows, request and obtain higher wages and better benefits. And if farmers did not offer those higher wages and benefits, the workers would leave for non-farm jobs. They would have to build housing in order to employ H-2A workers. So the basic idea behind the Farm Workforce Modernization Act is exactly the same as what was tried in 1986. Legalize currently unauthorized workers and make it easier to hire legal replacement workers. The ultimate goal is to give agriculture a legal workforce, as opposed to the current situation in which about half of the crop workers are not authorized to work in the U.S.
And Daniel, before we turn to some of the changes, the specific changes, what have labor conditions been like for workers, not the unauthorized ones now, but the ones currently under the H-2A program?
Sure. Well, this has been a very fast growing workforce. The program, the size of the number of workers coming in has tripled in about the past decade, more than tripled. And there have been just really many, many cases of abuse, unfortunately. Advocates have pointed them out. There's been news reports. There's been government audit reports about how many abuses these workers face, about the type of exploitation that happens. And it's really the reason that it happens is because of the way the program is structured. The program ties workers to one single employer. And so the employer has a lot of control over them. They really have control over their ability to remain in the United States. And so you see cases of trafficking. Phil and I have done research on the investigations, the wage and hour investigations. There's, you know, millions of dollars stolen from H-2A workers over the years. And so it is really a problematic visa program. And, you know, the reforms that worker advocates have been pushing for are really so that these workers would have more rights and not face issues like wage theft and trafficking.
Now, Phil, as I understand the current state of the program, it's really more geared to seasonal farm work, the peach harvest in Georgia, say, or something like that. Dairy farming in Wisconsin is, you know, its season is all year. Does that make it hard for, say, dairy farmers to use this program as it's currently constituted?
Yeah, the theory behind the program, when it was set up first in 1952, is that if you're hiring workers to fill year-round jobs, you should be able to find workers within the United States. So the program is limited to seasonal work, and normally that's defined as a job lasting 10 months or less. The Farm Workforce Modernization Act would begin to change that by allowing up to 20,000 H-2A workers a year to work in year-round jobs. With that, of course, comes more complications. What do you do about the families of workers? H-2A workers are in the U.S. on average now about 6 months a year. So if we're going to have workers working year-round, and under the proposal, they could stay up to 3 years, would farmers have to provide housing for families as opposed to what they now are required to provide, which would be, which is typically dorm rooms where we'll have 4 or 8 workers to a room in bunk beds. So, yes, the proposed reform opens up more farm jobs to H-2A workers and raises other questions in the process of doing that.
We're talking about possible changes in immigrant visas for farm labor. Currently, negotiations going on in the U.S. Senate. With us, Daniel Costa from the Economic Policy Institute, Philip Martin from the University of California, Davis. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel, one sticking point, as I understand it, in the Senate right now, the bill that passed in the House would allow workers receiving these H-2A visas, if their rights were being violated by employers, it would allow them to sue to get enforcement. There's pushback against that from some in the farm lobby, and that's one of the sticking points in the Senate. Can you talk about that part of the bill?
Sure. So the what the bill does is it takes the Migrant and Seasonal Worker Protection Act, which is one of the main laws that protect farm workers, and apply it to H-2A workers. At present, it only applies to U.S. farm workers, and it is one of the key benefits, I think, of the bill is that it would increase protection for workers in this way. I do think that all of the noise that employers are making about it, the complaints about it, are really not, maybe not in good faith, because, I think most employers who hire H-2A workers are already hiring U.S. farm workers as well. Therefore, much of their workforce is already subject to and covered by MISPA, as the law is often known, and so therefore I think it's an important protection. I don't think that it's going to have the type of impact that employers are complaining about, because many of their workers are already covered by this. So I do hope that this is one of those things that stays in the bill if it moves forward.
Now, Daniel, again, we're in Wisconsin. Do you think, you said 20,000? I think. Year-long visas that could go up to 3 years. That's not a lot when you divide it up around the country. Do you see potentially a state like Wisconsin getting a big chunk of those visas?
Well, it's hard to say. There were about 437,000 year-round agricultural jobs, which could vie for those 20,000 visas a year. I mean, it would be only 20,000 in the first 3 years, according to the bill, and then there could be adjustments after. So potentially the number could go up, and those visas, because I believe they would last 3 years, and the 20,000, the numbers would add up. So you would end up having a higher number, and probably within a few years, a much higher number. So I do think that it sort of starts off small, kind of almost as a pilot program, but then it has the potential to grow. But you are talking about a lot of year-round jobs and just a small number of visas.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Yeah, to speak to that disparity of how many actual people would benefit from this program, when you look at just milking cows in the state of Wisconsin, virtually all of big dairy operations are losing workers that are, for the most part, illegal. And that's a huge amount of the workforce. So the question about the mistreatment of immigrant workers, these people live here year-round. They milk the cows every day, sometimes three times a day. And the question is, the entire industry knows that they're, virtually their entire workforce is illegal. So this program is not really doing much for them, and they do get mistreated. I guarantee you they get mistreated. And virtually everybody in this industry knows that.
Mark, thanks for the call. Philip, what do we know? And I assume this is by its nature hard to measure. What do we know about the extent of the use of undocumented immigrants in U.S. agriculture?
Well, in the problem we have is that the U.S. government surveys only people employed in crop agriculture, not in livestock agriculture. And they only employ non-H-2A workers. They only survey non-H-2A workers. And that's a 70 by 70 rule. So 70% of crop workers were born abroad, usually in Mexico, and 70% of them are unauthorized. And if you remember your fractions, 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.49, so half of the crop workers are unauthorized. In dairy, there's roughly 100,000 people employed in the U.S. dairy industry, a little over 9 million cows, 1.7, 1.8 million in California, 1.2 million in Wisconsin. And so, you know, if all of those three-year visas went to dairies, then you would have half of the U.S. dairy workforce under H-2A within 3 years. And as Daniel mentioned, you can adjust it up or down. I think the bigger, you know, the legalization issue is that those currently unauthorized workers could get legal work permits. And once they got legal, so if you did 180 days of farm work in the previous 2 years, you're eligible for a legal work permit that's good for 5 years, over 5.5 years. And you maintain your legal status so long as you do 100 days of farm work a year. And after you do that 100 days for 4 or 8 years, depending how long you've been here, you can become an immigrant and eventually a naturalized U.S. citizen. So just like in 1986, the theory is that you take people who are currently unauthorized, you give them legal status. Their employers have to improve wages and working conditions, or those workers might leave and go to non-farm jobs where they have higher wages or better conditions. That was the theory 40 years ago, and that's the argument today. Legalization empowers workers. We'll see. And it did not work that way in the late 1980s and early 1990s because more unauthorized workers came. We'll see if it works that way this time around. But it should be mentioned that efforts to bring about this kind of change have been going on since the mid-1990s. So we passed IRCA in 1986, and there have been efforts to bring about exactly what is being discussed now, at least for the last 20-some-odd years. It used to be called ag jobs. Now it was blue cards for a while. Now it's farm workforce modernization. So I guess I would not hold my breath that it will happen this time. It may happen, but people thought it was going to happen in 2006. They thought it was going to happen in 2013. So I guess in the political climate we're in, it would be difficult to bet money that that the additional votes will be there, that this will get passed, it'll get reconciled with the House and become law.
We're talking to Philip Martin, Professor Emeritus in Agricultural and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis, and Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, an immigration-related bill that would allow, among other things, longer-term work visas for some farm workers. You can still join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you're hearing about, whether you want this to pass, your questions, your experiences. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about an immigration bill that would change the rules on how long migrant workers could stay employed in agriculture in the U.S. Philip Martin with us from the University of California, Davis. Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute. And you at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jill is with us in Cross Plains. Jill, hi.
Hi. Thank you for the program today. I have a question for your guests. I'm just wondering how much a migrant worker is paid, you know, versus an American citizen who might do the same job. I mean, obviously, there must be a great deal of savings there that the farming industry is using the migrant workers. I just have no idea how much these folks are paid.
Jill, interesting question. Daniel, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, under the law, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, they're all supposed to at least be paid the minimum wage. But an H-2A worker is paid what's called the adverse effect wage rate, which is set by the Labor Department and which sets it in turn by the USDA survey of field and livestock workers, and it's set out by different regions. And that wage is higher usually than the federal minimum wage. What unauthorized workers earn, it's really hard to say because the surveys out there about farm wages, you know, survey both unauthorized workers and authorized workers. And so I'm not sure. Phil might have some more thoughts about that, but it's kind of hard to actually calculate and get a sense of what the disparity would be.
And Phil, Jill's question gets at kind of a core issue here. As I understand it, farmers have a hard time finding enough American citizens to do this often rigorous, difficult labor.
Well, there's several answers to this question. I mean, the adverse effect wage rate for Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan is $15.37 in 2022. So it's well above the minimum wage. The pro and con is this: the $15.37 is the minimum wage that has to be paid, but it also means that employers expect workers to work in order to earn that wage. And Daniel already mentioned the fact that if I come, 93% of the H-2A workers are from Mexico. If I come from Mexico and come to work for a farm for $15.37 an hour, the employer has to provide me with housing. I am there to work, and I will probably work extra hours and weekends if I'm needed. Whereas a local worker, a U.S. worker, including an unauthorized worker who settled in the U.S., may not necessarily want to work extra hours or weekends or other things. And so you often will hear that the Americans don't want to do this work, and that's why we turn to H-2A workers. And it's true that farm jobs, seasonal farm jobs, tend to be jobs, not careers. Relatively few mothers wake up and say, I hope my child becomes a seasonal farm worker. And so people, even children of farm workers who are educated in the United States, tend not to go into the fields. If you talk to a lot of farm workers, they'll say, this is okay for me. The average hired farm worker in the United States has about 8.5 years of education. And so people will say, this is good for me, given that I went to school in rural Mexico, but I want my children to get more education so they don't come out here. And so seasonal farm work has traditionally been a job that's filled by one generation of people without too many other job options, but their own children tend not to follow them into the field. So you can think of it almost as a treadmill that as people drift out of farm work after 10 or 15 or 20 years, then there needs to be a new infusion of people. And typically in the United States, that new infusion has come from rural Mexico.
Jill, thanks again for that call. Dan, I wanted to ask about one of the outcomes that sponsors of this bill are hoping for. They're saying this could help decrease food prices. Do you see a chain of events if this bill passes, these visas get altered, that it would affect food prices?
That's really hard to say. I think inflation has also been cited in the context of this discussion. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that labor costs are leading to inflation and rising prices. But one thing that the bill would do is it would stabilize labor costs for farmers, and that's one of the main reasons they want it, because it freezes the AWER wage for H-2A workers for a year, and then it sets up a new methodology, and then some of the workers will end up getting lower wages, or their wages just won't rise as fast as they otherwise normally would if this law didn't pass. And so it will stabilize labor costs. I don't know that we have a lot of evidence that it's going to do much on food prices.
And just our last, just over a minute, Philip, I know you're looking ahead. What do you see farming looking like over the next few years, short and medium term?
Well, the story of agriculture has been fewer and larger farms, squeezing out the middle. So the U.S. has 2 million farms. The largest 100,000, 150,000 produce 3/4 of all farm output. 3/4 of farmers are hobby and retirement operations. They lose money farming year after year. And the story in agriculture has always been, if you're in the middle, if you're too big to depend on a non-farm job or retirement or something, but not big enough to get economies of scale, you're in trouble. And that I expect to see more hired workers on fewer and larger farms. And the big question we're asking is, who will those farm workers be? Will they be the unauthorized workers today, legal guest workers tomorrow, U.S. citizens? It's, you know, at this point, we would expect more of the same, which is a mixture of all three.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Philip Martin, Professor Emeritus in Agricultural and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis, and Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. They joined us for a look at the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, a version passed the House. Now it's in the Senate. Negotiations going on. We'll see what happens. It deals with migrant farm workers and the way their visas work. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, explore the Great Lakes. A Midwest travel expert joins the show with great ideas for weekend getaways and more in the Great Lakes region. And, of course, you can join in and share your favorites. Do you have a favorite Great Lakes getaway? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. I cooked something new this weekend, new for me. I mean, lots of people have eaten it before. I bought a bunch of radishes at a farmer's market, and it came with the greens on. Now, usually when that happens, I just compost the greens, even though I know they're supposed to be edible. So this time I figure I'm going to cook them. So I did a dish with radish greens and chickpeas and stuff. Came out pretty good. I learned two lessons I can share with anyone else who wants to give a radish greens a try for the first time while they're in season. One, the leaves cook down like spinach. Like at the beginning, it looks like you're not going to fit it all in the pan. After a few minutes of sautéing, they're just like these subatomic particles. And two, everybody on the internet said take off the thicker parts of the stems because they're tough. They stay tough even when you cook them. They were not kidding. I missed a few of the stems when I was eating it. I hit one of those as like the consistency of a really thin shoelace. So not too appetizing there. Other than that, I highly recommend radish greens. Food experimentation news that you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, the White House Infrastructure Coordinator joins the show with a look at the impact of the infrastructure bill passed last year in Congress. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the labor movement has a 200-year history in the United States, but a lot of the stories of the people behind that movement don't always get told. Our next guest reports on the modern-day labor movement, and in her new book, she shares stories of the people, past and present, who organized their workplaces and led strikes. And she highlights the role of women, people of color, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community, who often led the way in grassroots labor organizing. From young women at textile mills in the early 1800s to people like Amazon employee Jennifer Bates testifying last year before Congress on union organizing efforts.
We hope that they will start to hear us and see us and treat us like human beings. It's frustrating that all we want is to make Amazon a better place to work. Yet Amazon is acting like they are under attack. Maybe if they spent less time and money trying to stop the union, they would hear what we are saying. And maybe they would create a company that's as good for workers in our community as it is for the shareholders and executives.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a part of a union or a union organizing effort at some place in your life or some kind of informal workplace organizing activity? Do you have thoughts? Do you have questions about the history of labor here in the United States? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kim Kelly is a freelance writer reporting on labor, class, politics, and culture. She's the author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we go into the history, Kim, your book is bookended by two modern-day movements, Amazon in your setup and a still ongoing coal mine strike in Alabama now. And you, in reporting on this, got to meet a lot of the organizers. Can you talk about what you heard from them that inspired you to dig into this history?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'd already been interested in labor history for a while. It's what I've been covering in my career as a labor reporter. It's a personal interest. But really, spending time in Alabama over the past year, well, over a year now, really just drove home this idea that, like, okay, I have this opportunity, I have this platform, I need to use it to elevate the voices of workers like Jennifer Bates or like Braxton Wright, like the coal miners and the warehouse workers and the Starbucks workers in Birmingham right now, who are all working together and trying to make their communities better and safer and more fulfilling, who are pushing up against these corporate interests and these bad bosses and these oligarchs who are trying to siphon away every drop of profit from this area and take it away, take it out of Alabama and away from the people who created it. And it's just been a really incredible experience getting to know folks in rural Alabama and in Birmingham who are leading this movement the way that they have for decades, if not centuries, even if the history books don't always reflect how important their role has been.
And I grew up in southeastern Michigan, auto industry country. And I guess if I thought, you know, union, it would be a bunch of mostly men, a big auto factory, mostly white in my neck of the woods there. And that's part of the story you're trying to correct. There's a lot of variety, a lot of diversity in the people who were fundamental in this 200-year effort.
Yes, we've always been here, you know, I'm also very familiar with the trope of the, you know, the white guy in a hard hat, because that's who raised me. My family, I'm from a very rural blue collar union family in South Jersey. Everyone's a construction worker, or a steel worker, or a teacher. Like, the union was always part of my life. And it wasn't until I kind of moved out of the woods and got to know more people and learned more about our collective histories, I realized, like, wow, this movement is so diverse and so multiracial, multiethnic, multigender. Every type of person has been involved in this long, sometimes very slow march towards progress, but they haven't always gotten top billing. I think it's easier for some folks, some institutions, to act as though the working class is just that guy like my dad, the factory worker, the auto worker, the person who's a little more conservative, doesn't care about social issues. But that's simply not the case. And it's never been the case. Even with, you know, auto workers in Michigan, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, and the Palestinian workers and Arab workers who organized with Black workers in the 60s to fight for better working conditions and for social causes. Like, that is such an important part of that history. It just doesn't get quite as much of a spotlight. So I wanted to make sure that I shined it on it real bright.
Well, and to that end, one of the first stories you share is in the early 1800s, the first maybe strike in the United States. They didn't even have the word strike then, young women working in the textile industry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, I think it was 1824. I think they called it a turnout back then. Just young women working in the mills who knew they were being exploited, they were being treated poorly, they were being paid poorly. They were, at that point, it was mostly young white women, farmers' daughters from the local New England area, who had seized on this opportunity to work in these mills as a way to build, you know, financial and social independence in a way that hadn't really been available to them before. And they were really excited for that opportunity, but were quickly kind of crushed and grounded to dust by the realities of what it's like to work in a mill. and they organized, they fought back, they went on strike, and they really kicked off what would become centuries of organizing and picketing and striking and just fighting like hell against the people who are benefiting from our labor but aren't willing to share any piece of those profits.
Talking to Kim Kelly. Her new book is called Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I've been a union worker for quite a while, and I'm from down south, so there's not a lot of strong unions down there. I went through this thing up here in Wisconsin where all these people were fighting like hell to get this right-to-work state. I want to tell you the people out there that are listening that are not in the union, don't be foolish. Your wages, the ones that get you through, that make it so that you can feed your kids, pay your bills, and all that, were brought up because they had to have a wage that would compete with what the union workers were making, because if they didn't, they would have lost union workers. You make a strong union, you make a strong community.
Jim, thanks for the call. Kim?
I mean, hell yeah, brother. That's exactly right. I mean, that's the thing. Building worker power, building working class power and community power, that's how we take care of ourselves and protect ourselves. Rising tide lifts those boats, and being part of the labor movement is just one, it's if not the most important way for a regular working class person to join with your coworkers and actively make their own lives as well as their coworkers' lives better. Like, it's just, it's a collective effort, and you're exactly right. It's one of the best tools we've got.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to move ahead a little bit in history, Kim. Post-Civil War, black workers, former slaves, organizing, sharecroppers, women who clean houses. Can you share a story or two of their efforts and the backlash they faced?
Of course. I mean, one of the most significant moments from that piece of history, I think hopefully a lot of folks know about them, and if they don't, they should read up. The Washerwomen of Jackson, black domestic workers who were women who organized and basically compelled, well, they demanded higher wages, standardized wages from the white employers who were way too comfortable and way too used to not paying them anything at all and to exploiting them and to really just not acknowledging the value of their labor and their humanity. They organized and they sent this open letter, and they made it very clear that we are united. We're an organization. We are going to push for what we deserve. They really set the stage for what would be really decades of more organizing, whether it's black workers in the post-Reconstruction South or immigrant workers in other parts of the country. Folks who have been the most marginalized have always had to push the hardest, but have fought the hardest too, because they started out with so much less.
And also on the backlash side of things, you write about sharecroppers who tried to organize to get, you know, more of a share of the cotton they raised, and were met with violence. Can you share a little of that story?
Oh, God. The Elaine Massacre, I think. I'm trying to remember the exact year. It's been a couple of years since I wrote the book, but it was, as you said, I think it was the bloodiest, if not one of the bloodiest, racist massacres in U.S. history. Essentially, a group of black farmers got together and they tried to organize and demand higher prices, standardized prices for their product. And in response, I mean, they held a union meeting, they engaged a lawyer, they were forming a union. But in response, white sheriffs and, you know, white men in the county, in the town, they came out, they ambushed the meeting, they shot up the church where the meeting was being held. And when some of the workers shot back in self-defense, the racist lawmen and racist white people in the town decided that that constituted a conspiracy, an uprising, rebellion. And they massacred hundreds of people. They arrested dozens. They tried to basically condemn, I think it was 12 men to death, some of whom weren't even there or involved in the union. Ida B. Wells, the pioneering investigative journalist and anti-lynching crusader, she wrote a pamphlet about it. And she really helped bring attention to their cause and to their plight. And she went down to visit those men and she snuck into the jail posing as a family member to get their stories. Like she was one of my favorite labor reporters on top of being one of the most important journalists in American history. So it's the kind of history of in this country that is hidden and is really ugly and is really poorly known, but it's just so important and so instrumental in understanding the past as well as our current moment in time.
We're talking to Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, sharing stories of the history of the union and the people involved in labor organizing over the last 200 years or so. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for a guest or a story to share, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, looking at the labor movement, its history, some of the people who made it happen over the last two centuries. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Cassandra is with us in Milwaukee. Cassandra, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, I know you were mentioning in the book, like information about Amazon and how Amazon doesn't want to unionize. And I won't say the pleasure of working at Amazon because it really is, they expect a lot of their employees and don't do a lot for them and don't advocate for them. But I've also had the pleasure of working for UPS that is unionized. And it honestly makes a big difference. A lot of people want to hone in on like the dues and that they need the money, but like, the money is here to protect you so that if something were to happen, like someone's on, like standing behind you, supporting you, making sure that you're not going to lose your job. You know, when I moved up into a supervisor position at UPS that I was no longer a part of the union, I was going to the union reps to advocate for my employees because upper management just does not care. So I really wanted to stress to people, like I've worked at Amazon and I've worked at UPS, and I can tell you 110% that being a union member is way better when in a warehouse setting. If not, you are going to endure a lot of abuse.
Cassandra, hi. Thanks a lot for that call. Kim, is that a story you've heard a lot from people?
I mean, the union difference is a very real thing. Cassandra's exactly right. Not only is it building solidarity with your coworkers and feeling that community and feeling like someone has your back, it's very literally having an entity with resources and legal power and, you know, some heft that's there for you if something goes wrong, whether they need to enforce a union contract that they bargain for you or you get hurt on the job, they show up, make sure you get what you're owed. Like it's really just having someone in your corner. And I think a lot of union members, myself included, would agree that even with the dues, like that's priceless. Like what you get back, you can't put a price on. Knowing someone is there for you.
Cassandra, thanks for the call. Laura joins us now in Wisconsin Dells. Laura, hi.
Hi. This is a great topic. And as an educational union member, I support the concept. And I'm just curious if in your research you looked into corruption within unions themselves. I mean, I remember the Jimmy Hoffa days. And I'm curious, who's monitoring how the unions spending their money?
Laura, thanks for the call. Kim, concerns about, especially in that Jimmy Hoffa era, corruption in unions?
Boy, that is a big topic, one that honestly is a little above my pay grade. I didn't focus as much on internal union politics and internal union practices in this book. There are a lot of great reporters that do. The Teamsters show up my book a few times, but when I wrote about them, I was writing about, actually, you know, there was this moment when during the Coors boycott, when they were trying to get other members of a community to come out and support them. They're trying to get Black and Brown community members. They're trying to get queer community members to come out and support this boycott. And at first, it didn't work because people didn't trust them because they had heard the stories. They had heard about Jimmy Hoffa. They'd heard about racism and corruption. They didn't trust this union. And the union had to put in extra effort and hire organizers from those communities and really focus on outreach and really show that, no, we mean it. Like this company, Coors, are discriminating against a lot of different people. They're harming all of us in different ways. We get it. We're trying to do better, you know, and it took extra work, but they put in that effort and the Coors boycott lasted for decades. So I think there's definitely room for improvement in a lot of unions in this country, but thankfully there are a lot of people who are trying to make them more transparent and more equitable and just better for everyone. So you got to have some hope, I guess.
Laura, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kim Kelly is with us talking about her book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Back to your calls. Debbie is with us at The Villages in Florida. Debbie, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say I am a union supporter. I grew up in the Detroit area, and so unions were always very strong. And that may have been what gave unions a bad name in the last 20 years, because they would defend people who can't be defended for what they're doing. For instance, I know of one person who is in electrical union that he doesn't show up for work and there's no repercussions. I know somebody else that doesn't show up for work. He was in the at the Ford plant and there's no repercussions. And when you defend something like that, you lose your credibility in being, I'm working for you. It isn't good for unions, and it isn't good for the companies.
Debbie, thanks for the call. And Kim, this is an accusation, I think, of unions, especially at their peak, that they might go beyond protecting workers and, as Debbie says, protect workers who aren't such great workers.
I think that's a common criticism and talking point that you hear, especially by people who don't support unions. It's just kind of a way to break them down and act as though they're a bad thing. They're not useful. They're not out to actually help people. And honestly, you know, not all union locals are created equal. Unions are not a monolith. Labor movement's not a monolith. I'm sure there's folks in here there who aren't doing the best job they could, just like I'm sure there's union members who aren't doing the best job they could. But I don't think it helps anybody to act as though isolated incidents of workers not behaving or union officials acting badly to condemn the whole movement, because by and large, unions and labor movement are a good thing, and they've lifted up so many people in this country out of poverty and into what's left of the middle class. There's definitely housekeeping that could be done. There's definitely people on both sides of that could pull their weight a little bit more, but I would never condemn the movement just because a couple people take advantage, you know?
Debbie, thanks for the call. Jim in Mequon called in, could stay on the line. Wants to know what you think about unions being accused of being socialist entities at various points in history, that this is a inherently socialist activity.
Well, I mean, some unions have been socialists. There have been a lot of socialists and anarchists, communists, progressives and radicals of every stripe have been a part of this movement. And whether or not people like to think about that, some of those very people have been some of the most important and impactful leaders. I mean, unions aren't inherently a left-wing thing or a right-wing thing. The right-wing is not particularly interested in the working class, let alone working class power. That's more of a capitalist, pro-business, anti-worker side of things. So sure, if you want to look at unions as an inherently left-wing thing in this country, by all means. But I mean, even at that question is sort of insinuating that socialism or being lefty is a bad thing. And of course it's not. And I mean, it's like it's acting as though FDR and Francis Perkins and policies like Social Security and all of the worker protections that came with the New Deal, that's acting as though like that's a bad thing because Francis Perkins was a socialist. And there are a lot of unions who are much more conservative, if not some might say too conservative, in the current movement. Like I said, labor movement's not a monolith. It's made up of people. People have different views. People have different goals. I would certainly hope that we're all on the same side when it comes to building working class power and lifting people up. But it takes all types, we'll say.
Just briefly in our last minute or so, Kim, one story that wasn't finished by the time your book was done and still isn't finished is this coal mine strike that hasn't gotten a ton of media attention going on in Alabama. And I think, as you described them, these are not what we would consider left-wing socialist workers in this strike. Can you give us just a taste of the latest there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been over a year. We're coming up, I think it's a year and almost 3 months. I have the 500-day mark circled on my calendar. It's coming up quick. 1,000 coal miners with the UMWA workers in Brookwood, Alabama have been out on an unfair labor practices strike since April 1st of last year. They're striking for better pay, safer working conditions, more time off with their families, really basic asks that they had had in a previous contract but were pulled away when a big Wall Street-backed company came in and bought up the mine and shook everything up. And they really need solidarity. They need support. They need as much as we can do for them because they've kind of been forgotten. It's an interesting story with lots of different nuances to it. A lot of those folks are conservative. They are Republican and Christian, and they love their union. You know, the labor movement is a really good way to see, to really illuminate the gray areas that exist in our alleged political divide and see the common ground that normal working class people can find for themselves. For a lot of those folks, it's a union, it's fighting for your coworkers, and it's fighting for what's fair. And ultimately, isn't that what everybody wants?
We'll leave it there, Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And the callers, thank you too.
That's Kim Kelly. Kim Kelly, author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, meet a Wisconsin researcher who won a major award for his up-close work on lakes, their ecosystems, and the impact of pollution. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.